Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Barry Agai. We're going to be discussing the fire economy and the Bay Area housing crisis. Barry Agai, it's great having you back on the show.
It's always a pleasure to be on.
And it was nice meeting up with you in person in Berkeley about a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it was definitely an edifying experience.
And I'm also joined here with Alex and Rabbit.
It's great to be on with you guys, as always. And Bay Area Guy, it was a lot of fun talking to you last time, so I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, I only hope this conversation can trump the previous one.
Yeah, we also did a whole show about my trip to the Bay Area.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check it out. Even though I don't feature as prominently, it's definitely fun to hear about my meetup.
So you wrote this review of Michael Hudson's book, Killing the Host, which is about the fire economy. And the fire economy, it stands for finance, insurance, and real estate. And you recently wrote a review of my interview with Laura Foote Clark about the Bay Area housing crisis, titled The Bay Area and the Fire Economy, and you tied the two issues together and how they relate.
Right, because normally when people think of problems related to housing, they often sort of attribute it to a problem of supply and demand or political complications, but after reading Michael Hudson's book, Killing the Host, there are actually far more sinister forces at work, because one of the neglected factors of exorbitant housing prices is the practice of banks, basically the way they lend money against real estate, which will always bid up the real estate value because assets are basically worth whatever banks will lend against them. So the more money that banks lend out for home loans, then that forces prospective home buyers to spend even more money and assume even more debt.
Do you think the issue was brought up adequately in the interview? I did bring it up sort of. I touched upon it briefly. I asked her something about the issue about rent as a redistribution of wealth from renters to landowners. Do you think it was brought up adequately?
Well, Laura didn't really, that is Laura Foote Clark, she did not really put it in those terms, but her discussion of Prop 13 and how it basically froze property taxes in time sort of demonstrates how in a rentier-based economy, the tax burden is shifted from the rent-extracting class onto regular people. So people who have owned property for decades that has massively appreciated in value, they're not paying the taxes that they ought to be paying, which means that newcomers, especially young workers and new businesses, have to assume a disproportionate share of the tax burden. And Laura also sort of pointed out how today's Bay Area employers have to sort of, a lot of what they pay their workers goes towards rent, so this actually reduces their competitiveness. And that's exactly what Michael Hudson talks about in Killing the Host, what he calls debt deflation, and the way that payments to the fire sector cuts off the circular flow between workers and producers.
Yeah, then on top of that, like, say an owner of a small apartment building, they're renting stuff out, but they also have to pay interest on loans to banks, so there's like this big food chain.
Right, and what's interesting is that one very important point that Michael Hudson makes in his book is that historically, representatives of the financial sector tended to be opposed to land rent. For example, David Ricardo, and they used to sort of denounce the unearned income that accrued to landowners. However, nowadays there's sort of been this unholy alliance between finance and real estate. And one of the main goals of finance is to attach debt to real estate rent and to basically collect all the interest payments that will come from any kind of real estate transactions.
you use the phrase rentier economy. Now I've only heard that
right.
I've heard that like in like Marxist terms. Like I've heard people talk about that from like a Marxist perspective. Is that like what what is that phrase? Like is that does it come from Marxist thinking? I'm not sure. Like what is that phrase?
Actually, not at all, because one of the most edifying points of the book is the way Michael Hudson discusses the envision sort of the reforms of or at least the reforms proposed by Adam Smith and other classical liberals and economic reformers, because it was actually Adam Smith and John Stuart Mill and Francois Quesnay and other classical liberals who really sought to sort of distinguish between earned income and unearned income, and they placed a very high premium on price and labor value.
If you look at Michael Hudson, I mean, he's probably one of the very top modern-day economists. He's obviously, he's not a Marxist, but he's not like a neoliberal or a follower of like Milton Friedman either. Mm-hmm. He doesn't explicitly put out columns, identify with an explicit ideology, which I think is smart because it makes more sense just to give out common sense ideas than to put yourself in a box. But he's definitely sort of influenced by this school of economic thought that goes back to like things like the distributist and the social credit movement.
Right, but I think what Hudson does so brilliantly is that you can't really pigeonhole him as a loony Marxist because he's really invoking the arguments of Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, that various libertarians and neoliberalisms often sort of invoke. And to answer the previous question, rentier income is basically income that is either earned unproductively. For example, let's say you're a landlord or property owner and you're just sort of sitting back owning your property and collecting the money. You're not actually doing anything. But rent can also take the form of monopoly price gouging or any other costs that are not basically any prices that don't have any costs of production. So, for example, the amount of money that Carlos Slim charged in Mexico with his telephone monopoly, the amount of money that Mexicans paid for telephone services far exceeded what those services were actually worth and how much it cost Slim's company to provide them. So it can also mean empty pricing.
Does Michael Hudson advocate abolishing rentals altogether? I mean, what are the proposals? Because obviously not everyone can own like a single family home. A lot of people have to rent.
Right. Well, what Hudson basically proposes is he believes that rent-seeking opportunities should either be nationalized or at the bare minimum, they should serve as the tax base and the tax burden should shift from labor and industry and onto this essentially unproductive parasitic class.
You brought up Prop 13, which I touched upon with Laura. And yeah. One of the big concerns is you have a lot of middle-class people in California who've lived here a long time and a lot of retired people, and they maybe bought their house when it was much cheaper, and it's gone up. The housing value has gone up, but if property taxes were based at market rate as opposed to based on their income, then those people would be priced out of their home. Laura's opinion was basically that those people, even though their income was not wealthy, they were wealthy in land.
Correct. So,
but what do you think about the argument that's made that abolishing Prop 13 would push middle class people out of their homes? And could there be some kind of compromise, like say property taxes should be based on a person's income? What's your response to that?
Well, I think it should be mixed because a lot of people sort of fail to distinguish between income and wealth. And I think Laura made a very good point in that regard. And that sort of reflects the way that junk economics has taken over, in the sense that when we think of the economy, we primarily think of labor, wages, industry. We think of people living off of their wages, and yet more often than not, as Hudson explains, the way Americans have tried to get ahead is living off of appreciating asset values. And I do think that suddenly abolishing Prop 13 and hiking the tax rate would have some adverse effects. And so I think there should be sort of a transition period. And yet at the same time, I do sort of concur with Laura that we do need to sort of build up the tax base again. And we can't just let this real estate rent go untaxed, because otherwise, as mentioned before, it'll be regular people like you and me who bear the burden.
And you're actually a renter in the Bay Area, so this interview affects you personally.
Right. And I think it's safe to say that the vast majority of young millennials are affected by this issue. I mean, you'd be pretty hard pressed to find a young millennial who owns his own place. I mean, they're exceedingly rare these days.
It seems that a lot of millennials are in this space where they rent and then they work a job and they just work enough hours to be able to pay rent and have some money to, you know, go out, you know, on Friday and Saturday night. It's like a lot of millennials who have recently left college, I feel like they've just immediately adapted to a paycheck to paycheck life. Like the career mindset that existed in, you know, the early 2000s really doesn't permeate through like this younger generation. The younger generation almost immediately accepts paycheck to paycheck. And I think a lot of like the moral puritanism of our time, like, could be like a return to religion for these people. Like, their universalist globalism is just their religion, as that gets them through their day to day as they go from paycheck to paycheck. Like, they've given up their future.
Well, I mean, I don't think that it's so much a philosophy. I think a lot of millennials just realize that they don't really have a choice but to live paycheck to paycheck, at least a solid majority of them. And in fact, I just read a very harrowing article about how a majority of Americans, not a huge majority, but a majority, would be destitute and bankrupt if they were suddenly confronted with a $500 emergency. So when you're just one bad break away from being trapped in a quagmire of debt peonage, then you sort of have to live paycheck to paycheck and conserve.
And that's the big point, because conservatives and libertarians, their concept of freedom is always being free from government control. But that's no sense of freedom whatsoever to live paycheck by paycheck or to be in a debt, even if it's involving the private sector.
Because the private sector can be just as oppressive, and as Hudson brilliantly notes, the real road to serfdom is not government spending or any kind of government deficit spending. Rather, it's this debt bondage and this growing polarization between creditors and debtors. We're slowly bleeding us dry.
You even see this with free speech. You know, it's the government is not going in and cracking down on hate speech or whatever. People are being fired from their jobs, you know, they're having, you know what I mean? Like, Brendan Eich was fired from Mozilla. So it's like the private sector is, you know, is where the free speech, like, you know, where free speech becomes a problem. It's not from the state.
Right. And what's very ironic is that you see a lot of avowed progressives defend the firing of people with supposedly offensive views by saying, well, it's the private sector's prerogative. They can fire whomever they want. The First Amendment doesn't protect you from the consequences of your actions.
Yeah, I mean, the phony left, they put out like corporate propaganda if it suits their interest. Like, one example is about like doing the jobs that Americans won't do. Americans will do those jobs. They just demand a higher wage.
Well,
and if you raise the minimum wage, that, and Ron Unz made that point on our show, if you raise the minimum wage, Americans will do those jobs. And so you can make the same with, so liberals.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, like, I worked as a custodian, and I had my job replaced by, you know, a private company. I worked for the town, and it was, you know, basic, you know, we were custodians, like me and some of my friends and, you know, the people in the town were custodians. And then a private company took it over. And the people that work there, I'm pretty sure, are illegal immigrants. Or you know, I you know, maybe they're, but they're like Mexican guys. And, you know, I've had my job even, you know, not necessarily taken from me, but, you know, there was a public, you know, cut, and it was taken over by a private sector. Like, it happened to me. So I don't even know if it has to do with, like, raising the minimum wage to give people jobs. I think people have jobs that others necessarily don't want to do. There are people that are in that area, and they're having their jobs, quote unquote, taken from them now.
Barry, a guy, you did point out that immigration plays a role in the housing crisis and supply and demand. We didn't really get a chance to go into that in the interview.
Right, and I don't even think the word immigration was mentioned at all. And one thing I pointed out in my review of your show is that I do sort of look at Laura's liberal attitude towards population growth askance, because at some point, you know, you can only accommodate so many people. And, you know, even if you tried to have housing on blimps or some of the other more interesting proposals that were mentioned, at some point you have to find a way to reduce the demand for housing. And the Bay Area is kind of overcrowded as it is. And unless you turn it into another SoCal with its strip malls and identical tract housing over the place, then
SoCal is more like a sprawl model with like all these tract housing and strip malls. I mean, the Bay Area has that in some places, like parts of the Silicon Valley and some of the suburbs in the East Bay, like Dublin. But for the most part, the Bay Area is a lot more compact.
Right. And I think that a lot of that is, as we've discussed before, it's political in nature. People sort of like being in an environmentally beautiful area, and of course they also want to preserve their property values.
And you sort of see that, like, Southern California, I mean, you can drive literally from Santa Monica in the beach inland to San Bernardino County and down to Orange County, and you can drive like 2 hours and see nothing but sprawl. I mean, in the Bay Area, despite all these problems, it is nice. You have a large chunk of wilderness between the Silicon Valley and San Francisco in that whole, like, peninsula area where all the tech elites live. And there's another area. I remember when I went up there, I stayed in Walnut Creek, and the drive from, like, San Jose to Walnut Creek, that area also goes through a lot of, like, open space, and you even see, like, cows grazing. So those are qualities that do make the Bay Area, like, more livable than a SoCal.
Right, and I suppose the balance we then have to strike is finding a way to make housing more affordable without sort of losing that element of Bay Area, the whole Bay Area scene.
The thing is, a lot of people are proposing, building density and more compact development, and I think that's a viable solution if it's combined with, like, immigration reduction. I'll give you one example. I was reading that in Tokyo, Japan, Tokyo is one of the most expensive cities in the world, on par with the Bay Area. But what they're doing is their population is, like, stagnant to the point of even decline. But there is, at the same time, they're increasing their housing supply. So even though it's expensive, it's gradually becoming more affordable. What we're doing is California's population is growing massively through immigration, but at the same time, we're not building enough housing to keep up with that growth. So that, on top of the fire economy, that encourages an increase in supply and demand. But I think the combination of addressing mass immigration and then increasing density in some areas, I think the combination of those two would address those issues, but most, no one's really talking about that. Like, liberals tend to be very pro-immigration, and then mainstream conservatives, you get different, you get like the NIMBYs who oppose all growth, and then you get some mainstream conservatives who are like apologists for suburbia. So no one's really proposing that kind of a balance.
Right, because in order to really resolve this issue, you ultimately either have to reduce immigration or you also have to remove this rentier overhead, because, again, a lot of the increase in housing prices has to do with banks lending money against real estate and bidding up its value. And all of these payments to the essentially unproductive FIRE sector impede economic growth and result in a reduced standard of living. And just imagine what young Bay Area workers could do if they were not obliged to pay such a large chunk of their income to creditors, to landlords, to health insurers. That alone would significantly mitigate the problem.
So you live near the Silicon Valley. One issue that Laura brought up was that all these techies from the Silicon Valley are pouring into San Francisco. That's putting pressure on the cost. And part of the problem is a lot of the Silicon Valley. I mean, I drove through it on my last trip. It's just all these like boring, bland suburban office parks. If you made that into a kind of a vibrant, like a dense, walkable urban community, more people would be willing to stay there instead of moving up to San Francisco. And you were saying because you live close to Silicon Valley, you would like to see that. Are there, do you have places like near where you live where you see like those massive like parking lots surrounding suburban office parks?
Not exactly. One thing I do see that always sort of sticks out in my mind is whenever I'm driving by Highway 92 East, which goes towards the East Bay, I just see a massive amount of traffic. And you can tell that it's basically people from the East Bay who commute over to the peninsula and Silicon Valley and SF in order to work. So I definitely endorse Laura's solution of having Silicon Valley do its fair share to house these workers. And it would make everyone in the Bay Area a lot happier, to say the least.
And one proposal I've seen is like building housing. I know it's kind of like some people would find it kind of like Orwellian to kind of live where you work, but it would address a housing crisis.
Well,
is to build these like communities on the parking lots of the office parks to supply the workers. Are you familiar with those?
I was.
Yes, and that issue did come up during the interview. And yeah, there is definitely something Orwellian about it, but I think there are other ways to resolve the problem. For example, employers in general have been agitating for more housing development. And I actually read that one article you sent me about Lafayette being sued by Sonia Trauss. And how it was actually the CEO of Yelp who funded BARF in order to compel Lafayette to build more housing. So I think at least one segment of, there's definitely several segments of society that are pushing for these reforms. And you might actually see this unlikely alliance of rich employers and desperate millennials.
I actually got a chance to visit Lafayette on my last trip. And the thing is, it's not like your stereotypical, like a suburb with like a track housing and strip malls. It's actually, it's kind of like it's actually a really nice place. It's like a small town surrounded with a lot of wilderness and a kind of semi-rural setting, but it also has a BART access. It's not like your stereotypical suburb. But what's interesting is I listened to an interview with Sonia Trauss. I'll link to it on this podcast, like a Vertical Cities. And Sonia, Trauss was making the case that she would like, one of her points was that she would like to see actually more immigration and that the Bay Area should build more housing, like to accommodate like refugees, like the Syrian refugees. But she made another point was that she brought up that the city by Lafayette was over 80% white, which is pretty rare. Plus by 84. Yeah, I mean, I drove through there. I mean, it's that is like extremely rare by a by urban California standards. I mean, you'd have to drive up to the Sirius to find that kind of demographics. But she was kind of implying that the people in that town were, they didn't want like too much diversity.
Well, and here's the thing though, if every area is diverse, then no area is really diverse, because in Oakland, whites are only, say, a little over 20% of the population, though I'm guessing that's changing now on account of gentrification, but that's beside the point. Basically, you're going to have different demographic balances everywhere you go, so I don't see why it's so wrong that some communities are predominantly white. It's not like most are.
You wrote an article about the Bay Area demographics, and you didn't bring that area up. Would you say that it's ultra-liberal the way Marin is, or a little bit, would you say, politically more moderate?
Well, I confess that I don't really know as much, because I'm primarily familiar with the Peninsula, Silicon Valley, SF, and to a smaller extent, the East Bay. I'm not quite as familiar with that Lafayette and that part of the Bay Area, but based on my admittedly limited experience, I would say that they're liberal to an extent. Typical Bay Area social justice meets...
One thing I noticed was I stayed in Walnut Creek, which was right next to Lafayette, and I didn't see... I saw very few political bumper stickers, but as soon as you go to Berkeley or SF, you see more Bernie stickers, neither Trump or Clinton.
I think a good way to characterize these affluent Bay Area liberals is that, yeah, they're cool with gay marriage, they're cool on social issues, just stay the hell out of their neighborhoods, and they're happy. So as long as the business of America remains business and the boat's not rocked too much, they're not especially passionate about politics.
One other trend I noticed was that that area I stayed in, like Walnut Creek, Lafayette, it's the only place in the Bay Area where you see like white people with like families. Like, you don't see that so much in SF or the Silicon Valley.
Well, right. I mean, it's pretty hard for families to inhabit SF these days, unless you're affluent tech workers. So, yeah, SF definitely has a very interesting demographic distribution. And, yeah, it takes money to raise a family, so I'm not especially surprised that you see more families in affluent whitetopias, if you will, such as Lafayette.
I met this guy over the weekend and told me he was from California, and he said, like, when he goes back that he hates it because he just says there's tech bros everywhere. And it seems like in every person I talk to, it doesn't really matter where they're from. It's like there's this idea of, like, the invasion of the tech bros.
Was he from the Bay Area or L.A.? Because I know L.A., there's this whole hype about, there's this new phenomenon called, they're calling it L.A. now, like the Silicon Beach.
Yeah, I think he's from L.A., yeah. So,
okay.
So there's this Silicon
Beach. So the Silicon Beach is like, that's like Venice and Santa Monica.
And that's like Silicon Valley, but the Los Angeles version?
Yeah, but like, there's all this hype about it because, like, they're like surfer bros. They're not like the nerdy Silicon Valley guys. Like, there's all this hype.
Oh, it's like tech bros. Okay.
Yeah. Rabbit, you were saying the same about Phoenix, I remember.
Yeah, the same thing happens in Phoenix. We have a lot of the same kind of tech bros. A lot of those Bay Area companies actually have offices here. You know, Yelp and... reputation.com, and there's at least like 30 or 40 of them that have offices here, all of these internet companies. It's become kind of a big hub where a lot of these places have their like second offices that they're building here, partially because the overhead here is so low and their property taxes here are extremely lower than I'm sure that they are in the Bay Area, even with the freezes and things that they have in place there. So you see a lot of tech bros and things like that. And, you know, going back to what was said before, I really hate the argument when people use that they say, like, oh, you know, these immigrants are doing the jobs like Americans don't want to do, because it implies that, like, that these immigrants are only taking, like, unskilled jobs, and that these, like, white people that live here, they just have no skills, you know, and it's really their fault. But really, the immigrants are taking jobs at all skill levels.
Right.
They're, you know, computer programmers are coming. It's not just, like, people coming in to pick fruit. Like, you have, you know, the CEO of Microsoft is an Indian. So it's like, okay, yeah,
yeah. Jobs. One thing I've noticed with, like, a mainstream conservatives is they like to bash, like, poor immigrants, like illegal immigrants, and they say, oh, these, like, poor illegal aliens are going on welfare. But as soon as it's a rich, successful immigrant, like, these people are the best people in the world.
Yeah, and there's one point that I feel compelled to mention is that studies have consistently shown that wages for even STEM workers have been stagnant. So whenever you hear employers bemoan the shortage of skilled workers, they're basically full of it, because if skilled workers were really so scarce, then their wages would necessarily rise. So we can immediately dismiss such arguments about a skill shortage as nonsense.
I know there's been a lot of hype about techies gentrifying the Mission District in San Francisco, but I got a chance to kind of drive for that area. Like, I saw some techies and some hipsters, but I would say, like, for the most part, that's still a pretty, like, a kind of working class, like, a Hispanic area. Maybe I was in the wrong section, but from your observations, how much of an issue is? I mean, I drove up Mission Street. Maybe it's a different part.
Well, based on my recent journeys into the Mission, not especially recent, maybe say a couple of years ago, but there is definitely more of a hipster presence. So while it still has some of its old Latino vibe, you can sort of get the sense that the Mission is beleaguered in an economic way.
Well, Rabbit, what were you saying about, there was something you were going to say about, was the CEO of Pepsi?
Oh, well, the CEO of Microsoft is an Indian. So it's like when people are like, oh, these are the jobs Americans don't want or won't do. It's like, okay, like what? Like CEO of a major corporation, like Americans don't want to do that job or aren't qualified. And Bay Area guy brought up another good point, which is they always say that, that they can't find these skilled workers. They're not available, which really that is code for they want to pay people less.
Oh, exactly.
So when they say, like, oh, you know, we can't find skilled workers to fill these positions, what they really mean is that they want to bring people in who will work for, like, 10 or 20,000 less per year. And because, again, you see this at all skill levels because, remember, I mean, in the 90s and stuff, when I was, like, a teenager and stuff, these customer service type phone jobs were very prevalent, you know, where you'd make, like, $12 to $15 an hour. Well, since then, like, most of that stuff is now outsourced to India. So it's not as if they can't find people to do those kind of customer service jobs here. They just found that they can, you know, pay people $3 an hour in some other country to do it. And and so it's really, it's a scam. And the CEOs are, they're all, like, multi-billionaires. You know, it's almost a joke, like, you know, like Jeremy Stoppelman, you know, the Jewish CEO of Yelp, like, you know, they have offices here and they pay these salaries that are just pathetic, and then they claim that, like, oh, this is what they can afford. Well, you know, if you were a CEO or something and you make whatever, how many, like, millions or even billions a year, like, you know, and you have, like, 1,000 employees, like, you could afford to pay those people $10,000 more a year. Like, what, you know, you're pocketing all of this extra money, so don't act like you can't afford these people and you've got to go to Guatemala or something.
Right.
You know?
And in order to steer this conversation back to killing the host and the fire economy, I do want to point out that these low wages are ultimately bad for capitalism and the American economy as a whole, because When workers suffer from stagnating wages, that means they have less money to spend on goods and services. This, in turn, provides employers and businesses fewer incentives to hire labor or invest in production. And so the economy grows poorer. And then the only way for people to get ahead is if they assume large amounts of debt and hope, beyond hope, that their assets somehow appreciate. And this ultimately leads to an economy built on debt leveraging and basically bubbles. It's a giant Ponzi scheme, and the inability of regular people to buy goods and services and all the people living paycheck to paycheck, that's a serious issue, even if you don't exactly care about these workers the way most rich people don't.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at Henry Ford, Henry Ford's economic philosophy was that workers had to be paid a decent income so they could afford his goods. And that kind of ties in with that whole topic of like a national capitalism. We've talked about that, and I did a show of Dota about that. But the problem now is that these multinational corporations, they're global corporations. So at this point, they could care less if the American people are impoverished.
Right. And Dota once said this to me in a private conversation, but the end game of our wealthy elites is to essentially turn the United States into, not the United States, the world into a giant sweatshop where everyone is expendable and everyone can be replaced by a cheaper worker.
Well, wasn't that Hillary Clinton? She gave us, there was the WikiLeaks, one of those private speeches to the bank she gave.
Right.
And I believe the phrase she used was a hemispheric market with open borders and free trade. Something like, you know, just this like Alex Jones fever dream turning into reality.
Yeah, well, free trade and also the free movement of finance and capital. So that means that predatory hedge fund managers like Paul Singer will have an even easier time looting impoverished Latin American countries.
One thing that was released in the WikiLeaks about Hillary Clinton, and I forgot to bring this up in our last show about the debates, but Hillary Clinton in a speech, she dismissed Bernie Sanders supporters as losers who live in their parents' basement. And that reminds me of what that
Rick Wilson,
who was that? Rick Wilson said
about
that.
Yeah, he said that he's like the
alt-right
or people who won't matter in the general course of history because they're
exactly
single, childless men who masturbate to anime porn in their parents' basement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's just one of those things that you have to rub in the face of any one of those cuck-servatives, you know.
Right.
Well, but at least the cuck-servatives, they're honest. They have an explicit ideology that people who have more money are like, I think that kind of has its roots in Calvinism. People who have more money are morally superior. Hillary Clinton is running as a progressive or a liberal. So, I mean, she's clearly, we obviously know this, but to the public, that obviously exposes her as an economic elitist, saying that these Bernie Sanders people, because they're struggling economically, they have no value.
Right. And one other interesting revelation from the WikiLeaks, again, to bring up the fire economy, is she basically said to, in one of her Wall Street speeches, she basically said that she trusted Wall Street financiers to do the right thing in managing finance and that they, of all people, know what's best. And what's interesting is that even though so many people rail against any kind of government spending or government deficits, one very important point that Michael Hudson makes in his book is that all economies are planned in some way or another, and that these rentier apologists don't actually object to planned economies in and of itself. They just want economies to be steered by Wall Street, whom Hillary says are best positioned to control finance.
Are there other examples of countries that have moved away from a fire economy?
Moved away from a fire economy?
Yeah.
Well, I would say that Germany still practices a healthy degree of industrial capitalism as evidenced by their large trade surpluses.
What's interesting about Germany is if you look at, like, well, obviously America, but other European countries, England's a country that is a major center of finance, and there's a lot of wealth that creates a lot of wealth for people like living in London, but they've outsourced their manufacturing base, and England, the rest of England outside of London, is impoverished. I mean, Germany's been devastated by the migrant crisis, but prior to that, I mean, Germans are very advanced culturally in a lot of ways, but one of the reasons that Germany is this economic superpower in Europe for a long time is that they have all this high-end manufacturing. They make high-end luxury cars like Audis, Mercedes, BMWs, but they also make a lot of high-end kitchen appliances. And Japan's another country that has like a high-end manufacturing. That's one of the factors why Germany has long been an economic superpower and had a strong middle class as opposed to the UK and the United States.
And what's interesting too about the UK and the United States is that if you look at their histories, then you'll see that they sort of enjoyed their initial dominance and rose because of protectionist, mercantilist measures. And countries like Britain did not liberalize their trade until after they were already industrially dominant. And for the longest time, the U.S. resisted British attempts to liberalize American markets. So those who promote free trade are often doing so in bad faith or are either ignorant of how rich countries became rich countries in the first place.
In the book, The Fire Economy, Michael Hudson does get into healthcare. And I touched on this on our last show we did about the debate about healthcare.
Right.
And the big debate between liberals and conservatives is whether healthcare should be public or private. But no one's really discussing the elephant in the room, which is basically that the whole insurance scam is basically like a usury.
Yeah, pretty much. And here's another interesting thing I've sort of thought about regarding public versus private health insurance, because obviously rich people and their apologists will insist that private health insurance is much more efficient, and obviously any kind of socialized medicine is tyranny. But if they're so pro-business, then if anything, they should support a universal healthcare system, because as Adam Smith and the other classical reformers envisioned, government was supposed to play a big role in subsidizing key infrastructure and services such as roads, healthcare, education, etc., because by doing that, it would lower the cost of doing business. And if you think about it, all the money that employers have to pay for employee health insurance plans in order to attract the best talent, in many ways, that's deflationary, and it's money that employers are not spending on research, production, new hiring. And so if you're a pro-business conservative, then I don't see why you are not supporting universal healthcare.
And Michael Hudson also debunks the whole sort of lie of like supply-side economics. If you cut taxes on the ultra-rich, you stimulate the economy. I mean, his point is that if you cut their taxes, they spend money on products that they already own, like a luxury real estate.
Right. And what's interesting is that, you know, these apologists for the rentier class have been present throughout history. I mean, it was Thomas Malthus who actually tried to defend landlords in his time by insisting that, hey, they hire butlers and coachmen and they spend money on fine clothing. Look at how they stimulate the economy. But of course, that's nonsense. And most of what they spend their money on is either luxury apartments already built, as you sort of mentioned, or even worse, they often lend their money out at interest. And so they often get rich by sort of indebting the rest of the population. And so that's why when we speak of this divide between the rich and the rest, we can't just focus solely on the fact that they have more money than us. More importantly, they're rich because they hold us in debt.
I know a lot of people who are, say, upper middle class or moderately wealthy. I mean, they're being exploited by the FIRE economy as well. Like they said, they have these massive mortgages on their homes, even if their homes are like worth $1 million. I mean, they're sending their kids to college in a massive debt. But the problem is, even though they're being exploited, they view themselves as kind of part of, as aspiring to become wealthy. So they kind of, put up with it.
Right. And one interesting point that Hudson makes is that every single economic recovery since 1945 has always added more debt to the books. And so even though wages did temporarily rise, Americans have not been able to fully take advantage of any wage increases because they have to pay so much money to the FIRE sector. Right. And of course, regarding the whole attitude that Americans aspire to be rich, well, again, I think that goes back to the whole Calvinist mindset that your income is a reflection of your character. And so Americans kind of have this notion that if you're not rich or successful in that sense, you're a pathetic loser.
So you've mentioned the Calvinist mindset.
Right.
You mentioned it earlier as well. So how has this mindset sort of existed from like the colonial times to today? How has it not, you know, just been sort of swept away by other trends? You know, how has that stayed a constant despite like demographic changes happening?
Well, I'd say American propaganda is one heck of a drug. But the reason why I bring up this Calvinist mindset is because it also sort of ties into my post, because when a lot of people speak out against inequality, they sort of do so from the standpoint of unfairness. It's unfair that the rich have so much money. But by doing that, they allow the rich to sort of depict people calling for more economic equality as losers who want to punish success. But what makes Michael Hudson's book so brilliant is that he basically lays bare how so many of the rich actually make their money in the first place. And they don't do it by working extremely hard or providing a genuinely valuable service or by enhancing society's standard of living. They basically make their money through various unproductive ways or predatory ways. And so they don't deserve their wealth.
There are some like core philosophical beliefs behind economics. The sort of standard leftist egalitarian view is that everyone should have the same amount, and this is like this applies to like Marxist thought. Everyone should have equal amount of wealth, but there's also this thinking that distinguishes between a parasitic wealth and productive wealth. And that school of thought kind of has its origins in things like producerism and distributism and kind of like a third way economics that's outside of both Marxism and capitalism.
Well, I would say that this distinction is actually at the heart of original capitalism. And basically the goal of original capitalists was to free Europe from the legacy of feudalism and basically bring this unproductive, parasitic rentier class to heel. And in many ways, what's happening right now is we're sort of reverting back to a neo-feudalism.
Yeah, I mean, even Adam Smith, the founder of capitalism, he warned us against having a society that is sort of the ruled by the merchant class or the capitalist class.
Right, and Michael Hudson actually even quotes Adam Smith, who said that profits are highest in nations going fastest to ruin. And so if you look at the United States right now, then we may be in for some very turbulent years ahead.
Are you familiar with the concept of like an anti-capitalist free market like Proudhon? What do you think of him?
I'm sorry, can you please repeat that?
Are you familiar with like concepts of anti-capitalist free market? Like Proudhon, I think like mutualism is an example of that.
I confess that I've never really heard of them. Oh, so how exactly would an anti-capitalist free market play out in practice?
Well, I mean, it sort of comes from a like more of like theoretical field of economics, like from a left-wing perspective. It really doesn't make a lot of sense to me, to be honest.
I've heard of distributism, mutualism is something. I've heard Keith Preston mention that word. I'm not really sure the definition, but like distributist is sort of in some ways they came about as a reaction to capitalism, but they're some you can make the case that distributists want to restore capitalism to its true intent. They want like a true, genuine ownership society where everyone owns their own business as opposed to monopoly. Like a distributist would say the problem with capitalism is that there's too few capitalists.
Well, based on that, I don't think Michael Hudson in his book goes that far, but he does basically note that there are various distortions in the market. And in fact, that the whole notion of the free market has been perverted because the original free market reformers, when they said free market, what they meant was freedom from these predatory landlords, monopolists, and bankers. But today's neoliberal junk economics have somehow twisted the meaning of the free market to mean freedom for the rentier class to basically do whatever the hell they want.
So would you say you come from like a classically liberal perspective in regards to economics?
Not exactly. I do sort of embrace the 19th century industrialist view that Michael Hudson frequently discusses. I do believe that for all of its faults, capitalism should be industrial in nature and produce real wealth backed by real goods and services. Now, of course, as I mentioned in my review of the book, industrial capitalism has various problems of its own. But before we can speak of economic egalitarianism, we actually need a real functioning economy and not this rentier fire-based economy.
Can you talk more about what Michael Hudson has to say about Wall Street, the banking system, debt, and interest?
Well, as Michael Hudson very persuasively argues, contrary to what various Wall Street apologists say, the primary purpose of banking is not to fund business and it's not to stimulate the economy, but the real goal of banking is to bid up assets already in place and to attach debt to various forms of rent. And so as Hudson notes, sort of like how a parasite attacks its host's brain and makes it the host think that the parasite is an integral part of the body, so too does the financial sector try to convince us that they're an integral part of our economy, even though rather than adding to the production process, they're basically making claims on the economy. So as someone who actually worked in Wall Street, Michael Hudson knows what banking's real objectives are.
Well, Alex and I interviewed this independent presidential candidate, Scott Smith, and he also worked in Wall Street. His ideas are kind of hard to put out in like layman's terms, but he actually makes the point that if you reform the financial system, you can have a social safety net without raising taxes. Alex, do you remember that candidate we interviewed?
Yeah, he was a really smart guy and who developed, I think he said that we're running a 21st century economy on a 19th century foundation.
And the thing is, his ideas were, they were fantastic ideas, but they're kind of, for your average person, they're hard, in layman's terms, they're hard to explain.
I mean, I'm sure with
not raising taxes, Hudson actually makes a very good point. He says that if you were to just solely tax economic rent, i.e. landlords, bankers, monopolists, then you would not have to levy taxes on the wages of individual workers. There'd no longer be any FICA withholdings. You wouldn't have to levy any sales taxes. So there is a way to improve industry without and create a more economically egalitarian society without having to tax most people.
Yeah, I mean, the candidate, presidential candidate, Scott Smith, he advocated like a financial transaction tax, or it's also called a Tobin tax. I know also when we interviewed, Alex and I interviewed Ron Unz when he was running for Senate, he proposed that. And what Ron Unz was saying was that if you have a Tobin tax of, say, like a 1% or 2%, if someone is a serious investor who wants to start up a company or invest in like a real estate project, their tax would be very minimal, but it would crack down on these like day traders who destabilize the economy, and then it would also generate a lot of revenue. I think a Tobin tax is a smart idea.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And one more interesting point regarding taxation is that a lot of progressives too often fail to distinguish between earned income and rents when proposing taxation solutions. For example, Thomas Piketty, who wrote Capital in the 21st Century, which I actually just finished reading, he basically proposes a global tax on capital, period. But as Michael Hudson notes, this failure to distinguish between earned income and rents means that rentier income and rent extracting behaviors are not being disincentivized. And so we really need to reform our tax system in a way that not only helps redistribute wealth, but also sort of incentivizes industrial and productive endeavors while also penalizing predatory behavior.
And how do you suppose one could actually go about like doing that? What laws would have to be put in place?
Well, I think it's very simple. You distinguish between wages that come from labor and industry versus income that you reap from capital gains or property, and you sort of make this clear distinction, and you reform the national income and product accounts and other measures of economic productivity in order to make this clear distinction.
We're getting towards the end of the show. Is there anything about Michael Hudson's book, Killing the Host, that we didn't get a chance to touch upon?
Oh, I mean, where to begin? There's so many good points in Michael Hudson's book that, I mean, I could have probably written a 10,000 word review of Killing the Host, but there's one more very important point that I think needs to be made regarding the book, and that's Michael Hudson's discussion of debt, because especially in American society, there's this whole notion that debts always must be paid in full, and that if people are indebted, well, it serves them right for being irresponsible and stupid. Again, that whole tough bootstrap rhetoric. But as Hudson notes, creditors should also be liable for bad debts, because if you make a loan to someone without a realistic expectation of their ability to repay, then by definition, it's predatory. And so creditors should have to exercise greater responsibility when it comes to issuing loans. But instead, they simply get large organizations such as the IMF, the European Central Bank, and other powerful institutions to essentially act as their debt collector and reward their bad bets.
And we have this presidential election going on in these debates. Do you see any of these issues being brought up to any degree whatsoever?
Well, I do sometimes hear Donald Trump fulminate against the multi-trillion dollar debt that the United States has, but I don't think it's especially helpful because it doesn't really distinguish between public debt and private debt. And I think in general, our whole understanding of debt is very skewed. One more important point on another note to make about debt is that even though we insist that debts all must be paid in full, if you look at history, there are actually multiple examples of debt forgiveness going all the way back to palaces and temples in ancient Mesopotamia. And the rulers realized that unless they annulled unpayable debts, there would be social unrest. So the question that Michael Hudson really poses in the book is, should the claims of creditors come at the expense of the economy and society as a whole?
Rabbit, do you want to comment?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that neither of the candidates have really addressed the issue of debt, especially even like a student loan debt, how that kind of ties in a little bit along the same lines, where it's basically people becoming enslaved for life to these debts.
Bernie Sanders is kind of
becoming a neo-feudal. Yeah, Sanders did, but you know, even when Sanders does it, like, he doesn't really, you know, he doesn't really provide an actual framework.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it seems
for any of his ideas.
It seems like Hillary Clinton has basically adopted this watered down version of his platform. Like, she did bring up college debt.
Well, she gives lip service to, like, income inequality or these slogans, like, the rich have to pay their fair share. But obviously, she's full of shit. I mean, she hasn't put out any proposals.
I mean, at the end of the last debate, she's sort of just screamed, like, I support the Second Amendment, but there has to be some restriction. Like, it was so awkward. And it was so fake.
I remember we kind of, one of our shows we did, I must have been like a year ago. Well, I think I said something about, like, but the political ideal would be to combine the best of Trump and Sanders, but better yet, like, the political ideal would be to combine the best of a Pat Buchanan and a Ralph Nader, and you wrote an article about that, like, called The Radical Center.
I did, and I think that in most countries in the world, you do have that kind of balance where you have sane or relatively sane economics combined with nationalism, whereas here in the U.S., you have this very bizarre combination of neoliberal vampire economics and fruity social justice at the same time. So it doesn't really jibe too well.
Yeah, it's unnatural and sort of simulated. Like, it has to be taught to people. You know, it's sort of not the way people actually live their lives naturally.
Which is why we're now starting to see a rebellion against the globalist consensus throughout the Western world.
What is your prediction for the election? How do you see things going for the future?
Well, I've made my views on the election known before, but I think now I still stick by them, and I still don't really think that Donald Trump is going to win unless there's like a huge turnout. I mean, unless there's a, you know, depressed turnout among Democratic constituencies, I just think that the demographics are against him. But nevertheless, one thing I do like about this election is that regardless of what happens, we're not just going to be able to go back to business as usual. You know, the emperor no longer has any clothes, and the status quo will not remain. It will not endure for much longer.
We are at the end of the show. Bay Area Guy, I would like to thank you for being on. We've covered a lot of really crucial issues.
Yeah, it was great being on. It's always great having these conversations.
And also, thanks, Alex and Rabbit.
Thanks a bunch. It's always great to speak with you, Bay Area Guy.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. We should do this more often.